Welcome to Politics of Food. I'm your host, Christina Gonzalez. On this show, we explore the political, economic, and social implications of food creation and consumption, both locally and worldwide. What does the food we eat say about our society and ourselves? Let's dig in and find out. Hello, this is Politics of Food, and I'm your host, Christina Gonzalez. Today, we'll be discussing how the Me Too movement has impacted the food industry. I want to start off by saying that this discussion may be a trigger for some listeners. I believe these conversations, as challenging as they are, need to happen for change to take root. Restaurant workers are some of the most vulnerable people in the workforce. The imbalance of power among staff is vast, the turnover rate is high, there is virtually no safety net for the undocumented. So how do we examine and destroy the culture of harassment and abuse that takes place in our restaurants when victims don't feel safe enough to report it? In the first half of the show, I'm joined by writer Monica Burton, editor at Eater.com. We're going to be discussing her experience while writing about the Me Too movement and its impact on the women and men involved, as well as the restaurant industry, media, and the world. And then I'll be joined by Trish Nelson, who bravely shares her experience of sexual abuse by her boss, and the struggles to find the power and strength to speak on that experience. We'll also hear from listeners sharing their own stories of working in the restaurant industry. Let's get into it. My first guest today is Monica Burton, editor at Eater.com. Thanks for joining me today, Monica.
Hi, thank you.
So there was a moment when the Weinstein stuff came to light, when there was the Me Too reckoning within the entertainment industry, that I started thinking, like, we're going to start seeing this come out of other industries, thinking which one's going to be the one that was next. Why was it important for you to write about the Me Too movement in restaurants specifically?
I think, like all women, I was appalled to realize the extent of the abuse in this industry. I think the fact that the restaurant industry is very much a boys' club was well known. The fact that sexism is rampant in the industry was well known and definitely not as talked about in a way that would end it as much as it probably should have been before the Me Too movement started. I think as a restaurant reporter, what I want to cover, what I'm most interested in, isn't how the food tastes. It's looking at the industry as you would cover any other industry. It's an industry that involves lots of people. And for me, covering food has never been about just the food. It's been about the restaurants, the people that work there, their stories. And so this was an enormous part of that.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that I find is, you know, people find it really easy to say, believe women. They say that like it's a mantra, but then when it comes time to believe women and do the action of believing women, it doesn't really go hand in hand. Like, you could say it, but not necessarily put it to action. Why do you think that there's a discrepancy between those two things?
I think that there are a lot of bad men out there, and there are a lot of men in power. And I think that in the restaurant industry specifically, the people that were at the center of this, of these accusations, were people that a lot of people in the industry and outside the industry had looked up to for so long. And the media had built them up to be the kings of this world. People continued to go to the restaurants owned by bad men, even after these allegations came to light. And with the knowledge that the men who own these restaurants continued to financially benefit from their restaurants.
Yeah. I mean, so you, in covering Me Too in restaurants, you talked to some of the women who came forward about Ken Friedman, the owner of the Spotted Pig. What were some of the difficulties they let you know about that they faced in trying to come forward in that moment? And what difficulties did they face once they did come forward?
I think what I most remember is talking to Trish Nelson, who has been very vocal about her experience and has come forward. But I think in general, it was hard to come forward because Ken Friedman was so powerful and it could prevent them from getting a job elsewhere. The Spotted Pig was a very well-respected restaurant, and as were Ken Friedman's other restaurants. And so coming up against this person wasn't something to be taken lightly if you wanted to have a long career in restaurants.
There are also obviously women who protect men or who in some situations say, you know, the woman did something to deserve that, or, you know, you could have protected yourself better. Or in this sort of situation where April Bloomfield essentially ostensibly said, my career is more important than your safety. It's so much to reckon with. It's like, it feels so heavy that, like, where do we begin in fixing that culture?
I think there are a lot of people in the restaurant industry working to improve the culture, the working culture. And I think if you look at especially the younger generations of people coming up in the restaurant industry, they very actively don't want to support or replicate the systems that have existed previously. Safety in the workplace and a healthy working environment are increasingly important to people in restaurants. And I think the pandemic has brought this to light even further, because it's been made abundantly clear that restaurant workers are in such a vulnerable position on myriad levels. They don't have safety nets, and this opens them up to being abused. So I think it's something that people are thinking about increasingly, and I'm hoping that going forward, people will believe women and people will take active steps to protect them in the workplace.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I read, according to the Harvard Business Review, the restaurant industry is where they have seen sexual harassment and sexual misconduct be the most pervasive, with something like 90% of women in the industry and 70% of men having experienced it at some point. Is there something that is, you mentioned that one of the things that is unique to the restaurant industry is that not, like, it can happen in the shadows very easily. Are there other aspects of the restaurant industry that allow for sexual misconduct to be so pervasive?
Yes. I'd say that historically, the restaurant industry hasn't been at least the back of house hasn't been a place where women have been let into as much. And so sexism is kind of built into the structure of the restaurant industry. It's built into its history. Women aren't the ones who are promoted. They're not leading as many kitchens, and they can't enforce a style of managing that is healthy for women. And then there's also the brigade system, which is a very clear power structure that puts certain people at the bottom and certain people at the top. And I think that can encourage or allow for rather abuse.
What is the brigade system?
It stems from French fine dining, and it basically follows that the chef is the head of the kitchen, chef in French is boss, and then there's a very clear structure stemming from that down to the dishwasher, say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You wrote in one of your pieces that some of these men, it seems like they might be holding off for an opportunity for a comeback. Do you think it'll just be that simple that they could just wait it out and have a comeback, or do you think that things will just blow over?
I'd say it still remains to be seen what will happen. But I'm not looking to hear from the men at the center of these accusations in any way, and I don't think we want to see them coming back this year or in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I did see that some of them did try to come back, that they did try to get positions of power within their restaurants, and some of these restaurants decided to sever ties because they understood the economics of being tied to an abuser in that way. And I, and it seemed like in those situations, social media and that sort of outcry played a big role. Do you think that something like that would have been the case? Would owners choose to do the right thing if they hadn't been in the spotlight in that way?
If we're talking about men who have repeatedly done the wrong thing when no one was looking, I don't think so. What stopped them was people coming forward and those people having the support and the media attention to hold them accountable. And I think it really requires, as we've seen with the Me Too movement generally, immense support from outside forces to make change. And I think that another aspect to this is that people are able to vote with their wallets, so to speak. And if they don't want to support a man who has harassed and abused people around them, then they don't need to go to those restaurants where that man still financially benefits. And so I think that is really an impetus for them to cut financial ties. It's been better for the restaurants if they do. And so in my reporting from when we were at the height of the Me Too movement, a lot of it was around divestment and like encouraging and waiting for these men to divest from their restaurants and put them in the hands of people who will run a staff in a much healthier way.
And the other thing that I noticed in reading about this is that when allegations come forward, there's so much space that's dedicated to the person that is accused. We talk about, you know, the potential that's lost. We talk about like how the like repercussions they're going to face in their jobs, how that what that's going to mean for their livelihood, and we spend considerably less time talking about the victims. You know, how do we change that to make sure that that we center the focus back on the people that this is happening to, that we make sure that we talk about the opportunities and the livelihood lost of the people that come forward, and center the people that really should be centered in this moment.
That definitely takes an effort. And I definitely believe that those are the people we should be thinking about. I think in my own reporting, I feel that it's definitely been something we've tried to do. We try to spotlight the voices of those people who have come forward. And I think it's just as a reporter and as people in media, it's just something you have to be vigilant about in thinking about whose perspective you're considering.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I try to do as a consumer of media is that when I, especially like, because I'm very online, if I notice that someone writes about an issue from a, and like completely misses the perspective of the marginalized, you call them out, right? Mm-hmm. Like, is that a thing that people should do?
I think it's an ongoing conversation. In a way that it might not have been before. When I think this year, especially, I think there's been a lot of talk about when writing a profile or when praising a chef, maybe talk to the people that work for them. That has been a conversation this year in media, especially around giving awards. Having it be something that is taken into consideration. I think at Eater, we previously had an award called Eater Young Guns, and it's now, the program's a little different. It's called Eater's New Guard. It's not all about how good are you at cooking. It's what are your values? Have you done anything that would make it so you can't sign this mission statement and adhere to our values?
Mm-hmm. I mean, would anybody say that they, would they ever say no?
No, we also ask the people around them.
Okay. On the honor system. Yeah. I promise I'm not an abuser. what would be the most important lesson that you've learned during this time?
It's funny because I feel like my entry into food media is just very much in time with this. I started at Eater in 2017. So this has been the bulk of my career in food media. And so I think I'm learning just to focus on varied perspectives. I'd say it's important to not lionize chefs. I personally try to be a super fan of no one. And I think that is a good philosophy to look at everyone, not skeptically, but don't idolize anyone.
Thank you for calling the Politics of Food Hotline. I can't wait to hear your story.
Hi, this is Allison from Denver. I'm calling to answer the question that asks, as a restaurant employee, how would you like to be supported by managerial staff? As someone who works as a server, I would definitely say that the managers really set the tone for how staff treat one another, what boundaries are put in place and followed. I have a really good experience where I work now. I know my manager always has eyes on the floor. She watches how we interact and how we're treated by our customers. I would feel comfortable talking to her if someone crossed the line. In other restaurants I've worked in, I've had very different experiences. There were times I didn't feel safe, either after hours around coworkers who'd say inappropriate things or come on to me, or even with clientele who do worse. I feel like we've come a long way. It's because women have spoken up and because women continue to do so when they've been mistreated. So I feel grateful for them all.
Welcome back to Politics of Food. My next guest is Trish Nelson, a very brave woman who, despite fears of backlash, came forward and accused her boss, one-time lauded restaurateur Ken Friedman, of sexual misconduct alongside several women and coworkers. We'll be discussing her experience and more. Welcome to the show, Trish.
Thank you so much for having me.
So for folks who don't know and who aren't familiar, you used to work at the Spotted Pig. Can you let folks know what the Spotted Pig was like? What was the work environment like? What was the vibe there?
I think that the Spotted Pig was very unique. It came in a time of a lot of freedom. People were so excited about April Bloomfield's food that it became kind of a phenomenon, this idea of this, you know, bringing gastropubs to America. And so I think that there was a lot of energy, a lot of electricity, and it was a 24-hour party. I mean, it was just booming at the seams. Everybody wanted to be there. It was one of my serving joys. The wait to get in would be in 2.5 hours. So by the time you got a table, you know, often most of my guests would just be pissed. And it was my job to kind of like turn it around and create a magical experience. And I really did enjoy doing that.
One of the things that I've read is that that folks in the restaurant industry are the most likely to face sexual harassment or sexual misconduct of some sort. What do you think are some of the reasons why that is so pervasive?
Well, I think that for the reason of we are easily disposable, we are not valued, even though every single restaurant I've ever worked in has always said, we're a family. And, you know, there is a little bit of gaslighting that happens in these situations where, you know, it becomes a little bit of mind control, because when one person holds all the cards and can pull the rug out from your livelihood at any given moment on any whim, which they did all the time, it really conditions you to kowtow to whatever the structure is that they've created. And often that structure is very dismissive of anyone that is, you know, it's a class division between mm-hmm. the well-heeled and the working class.
Who was Ken Friedman?
Ken Friedman, you know, he was an A&R music dude. I mean, he came from the music industry. He had lots of friends. He was kind of known in circles as being the drug guy. He could be the one that would like provide the party wherever he went. And he really Well, the problem with Ken and April, they are, it was like living with alcoholic parents. You just never knew what you were going to get. Sometimes you would get the most warm, loving, kind, thoughtful person and generous and it was like, oh, this person is so wonderful. And then the next day it would be like nonstop screaming and like kicking things. And so you just didn't know. He was very temporal, and you never knew who he was going to be.
Yeah. Who was he to the restaurant?
He was the owner. He had the highest stake the highest percentage of the rest, owned the highest percentage. I believe Jay-Z built that space for Ken. I mean, they bought that space in 2004 and turned it into a restaurant for him. And April was originally, they were looking at people like Jamie Oliver, but Jamie couldn't do it and recommended April and Mario Batali brought in April, but Ken was the owner and really like the ringleader and the host. He loved to provide to celebrated people. It was actually he was really good at it. He was a great host. Mm-hmm. So that was a positive thing for him.
And who was April Bloomfield in this Spotted Pig family?
April was the executive chef, and she came in as the executive chef, but didn't have an ownership stake until I think after she got her Michelin star. She had been seasoned, worked at Chez Panisse under Alice Waters, and it was a brilliant chef. Worked her way up from the trenches. She's from Britain. She's from coal country in Britain, didn't have an affluent background. She is a working woman.
Mm-hmm. And what were your experiences with Ken? You mentioned that Ken was gregarious, life of the party, but also mercurial. What were the seedier parts of his personality, and what was his behavior like with waitstaff?
It really depended. Like he always greeted you with a kiss and like a hug and lots of touching, lots of like sexual innuendo, really flirtatious. But and then depending on, I worked for him for 6 years, just depending on the day, whether he would cross that line or not, you kind of learned as a waitress to just try to fly under the radar. Mm-hmm. And not, gain enough attention that you could be, that you would be liked while not be putting yourself in situations where you were going to be preyed upon.
What were your initial thoughts when his behavior felt, there's always like, this feels weird and uncomfortable, but I feel like I've been conditioned as a woman to sort of accept that as part of my reality as a woman. What were your thoughts when he like was very affectionate or very physical or did the sexual innuendos?
Well, I think, one of the things that's been hardest for me to grapple with in my post-Ken experience is how conditioned I have been in my waiting tables life to, it's not like we're on the floor of the stock market, it wasn't a corporate environment. And there is that element of the restaurant industry that is very casual and familial. And so it's not a normal job. And I was conditioned as a woman and as a servant to expect that a part of this experience would be me deflecting advances. Mm-hmm. And you become good at it. I mean, you become a tap dancer. And I didn't know how exhausting it was until I was able to remove myself from the experience.
Yeah. I mean, so I know that so often I would talk myself into like, that wasn't sexual harassment. That way I didn't have the weight of the like, oh, that was a thing that I experienced. At what point was there a point that was like, all right, I can't ignore that anymore? That is like very clear cut and it's not okay. Was there a moment? Were there multiple moments?
Well, I mean, there were multiple moments that were abusive, so many abusive moments and so many sexualized and objectified moments. I mean, I couldn't give you all of them, but there were plenty. But the time for me, I had been working for 6 years for them and considered myself to be a part of the family and considered myself to be a staple in their operation. I mean, we're building their dreams. We're dedicating our lives to build their enterprise. And I thought that I was somewhat regarded as being like, I mean, Ken's like 20 years older than he's in his 60s, mm-hmm. you know, and at the time he was in his 50s. Like I thought of him as like a grandpa. Like I didn't think of him as a sexual, you know, he wasn't an object of my affection by any means. And I trusted him with, I got to a place where I felt like after 6 years, I felt like we'd bypassed because there were girls that came and went that he had sex with, that he, you know, sexualized, that he had relationships with. I mean, that happened all the time. And I thought that I had kind of gotten to a place where I was looked at as like a daughter and not an object. Mm. And one night we went, you know, we all hung out, drank wine after our shifts. Ken smoked a pot. I didn't smoke pot really, but I felt like, I don't know if you ever saw that Friends episode with Rachel Green, where she takes up smoking to, try to be a part of like whatever it is. That's mm-hmm. that was kind of my experience with marijuana. I don't like it. But Ken offered to smoke a joint in his car. And I'm like, well, okay. So I went out to his car with him to smoke this joint. And he lit it for me. And then he lunged at me. And yeah, I mean, the thing that's the worst part of this story is that every single woman I know has a story like this. We're a first world country, and we treat women as if they are second class citizens. And I feel like that experience for me was what every woman does. Like, you know, you get that sheer panic adrenaline rush, and you freeze. At least that's what I did. I didn't, you know, I'm not going to punch my boss. I just, all of the things are going on in your mind. Like, how do you exit this situation without ruining everything? And for me, I had established myself and I didn't want to lose my career. And I just remember he, you know, stuck his tongue down my throat, grabbed my body. It was just sloppy. And he's very large. He's 6'4". So just overpowering. And I was feeling for the door handle and I got the door handle and I got out of the car. I got it enough so the door would open. I stood up and I feigned having to go to the bathroom, and I went to the bathroom and I burst into tears because it was over. It was there for me. I knew that Ken at that moment only looked at me as a possible lay or mm-hmm. as a, you know, as an object. Like, I didn't mean anything to that organization. At that moment, I recognized that. And so the next day I thought about it the next day, I was one of the oldest staff members there at the time. And I put in my notice. I'm so conditioned. I didn't just walk away. I trained my boss. Like, I trained the next person to come in. I trained the person that would take my position. I spent a month, like, it's like, there's this dignity or this idea of like, I don't, even if I've been violated, I still have to somehow show up and be dignified. And that was a part of my conditioning in that restaurant.
Yeah. That's so true. That like there's such a prize on tone, on like being polite, on like doing the right thing and being honorable.
Honorable. It's true. It's like it's somehow integrity is wrapped up in this idea that you have to like fulfill. I don't know. It felt very, upon reflection, I should have just been like, F you, I'm out of here. Good luck. Mm. You've got 20 events coming up, figure it out. Like,
yeah. Right. Did you talk to other wait staff when this happened?
No, because I was humiliated and I was embarrassed. I talked to my therapist about it a ton. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know that eventually Spotted Pig employees came together to speak out about it and create a civil lawsuit. How did those steps start?
Well, it was so strange. I didn't even know the lawsuit was happening. That came much later. I didn't know that the New York Times was writing an article about the Spotted Pig. I put a post on Facebook I think it was like May of 2017. And it was about a time when I'm in the performance world. I was in the New York stand-up comedy scene for over a decade. And Amy Poehler was up on the third floor and Ken is friends with her. And he's like, would you like to meet her? And I said, yes. And I did all the third floor parties at that time. And I was on my knees getting glassware. And Amy came over and I went to shake her hand. And before I could, Ken said, and while you're down there, and pressed my face into his crotch. And I immediately got teary because it's just, you're already a servant. You already get to feel all of those inequities, and then to be demeaned into somebody who is essentially like a person you are aspiring to be, is just such a manipulative tool to make you feel that you are nothing. So I posted this experience on Facebook, and one of the Spotted Pig girls reached out to me and said, hey, just so you know, the New York Times is doing an article on the Spotted Pig and would you want to be a part of it? And I was like, huh, no, because I didn't want to ruin my career. I mean, the restaurant industry is such a mafia. It's like such a close, especially when you start to work in that level of establishment, everybody knows each other. Like, I just didn't want to do it because I saw it as career ending. And I've also had been trained up until that point to not use my voice and to be fearful of using my voice. And so I just assumed that nobody would care. And that was, I didn't want to have to experience that kind of pain of people just dismissing these experiences. So I didn't want to be a part of it. But over time, you know, the New York Times staff is great. We did talk on the phone. They made me feel very comfortable. And they took 6 months to write the article. Like, they didn't just take my word. Everything had to be corroborated. I didn't understand how journalism worked. I didn't know in that high caliber of an establishment, they're not just going to print what you say. Like, so it was a long process. And by the time, but I still was going to be anonymous. And then of course, by the time it all happened, I was like, F it. Like, what do I care anymore? Go ahead, print my name. And so that New York Times article happened, came out, I believe, on the 17th of December, maybe actually, no, I think it was the 17th of December, 2017. And I was pleasantly surprised that the world didn't just tell us to all go screw ourselves. Mm-hmm. It was shocking and wonderful.
And eventually that led to the lawsuit?
Yes, that led to a 60 Minutes interview with Anderson Cooper, which also took like 6 months to put together. And then that ended up with Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, reaching out to us and asking if we would like to pursue a civil suit against Ken Friedman, and gave us the reasons why they thought it was, I mean, Letitia James is many people. She's got a full team of brilliant women, powerhouse attorneys. So working with them, and like at first, you know, we didn't want to do it because we didn't get any money, and it was never about money. And we didn't want the public to be able to misconstrue our purpose, which was we really just wanted to be able to speak the truth of what the experience is for working class women in this country, and not muddy it by attaching like a dollar sign to it, because that felt like it just didn't sit well with us. Mm-hmm. But after lots of conversations with them and really understanding like that it's more symbolic than about money, and how important it was to be able to do that, and to speak on that level about the how we need to change the dynamic of the industry and for working class women across the board, we decided that we would do it. And it took like a year and a half, almost 2 years.
What did it feel like to testify?
Well, see, it wasn't that kind of case.
Okay.
Because in a civil suit, he just perjured himself so many times during the process that his lawyers would never have wanted him to go in front of a jury. Mm. It would have been a mess for Ken. And because he's so temporal, because he's one day he's this person, the next day he's this person. So he's constantly giving you another story. And when you're giving another story on a regular basis to an attorney general, it's a little dangerous. Mm-hmm. for you. So it could have gone to trial. It was settled out of court, for $240,000 split between 11 people. So mm-hmm. over a 2 year period. So he pays in installments, each of us, $20,000 over 2 years.
Okay.
One person got a little more because her experience was extremely volatile.
It was worse than this.
Yes.
Part of the reason that you didn't come forward for a while and why you didn't feel comfortable is because of the very real fear that you'd be ostracized, that you would be looked at like you deserved the trauma that you endured, that you asked for it in some way. Sometimes people are surprised. Was there anything about the experience once you came forward that was surprising to you, where that usual stuff that happens didn't happen and instead something else happened?
Well, I mean, I honestly was, if I was a betting woman, I would have lost a lot of money because I was certain that our country would just destroy us, that they would put us in our place immediately. Like, and because that's, I've been a waitress for over 20 years or various levels from, you know, I've done everything in the restaurant industry. So I've been in the service industry for that length of time. I was just conditioned to believe that this was a death sentence. Saying anything, especially when you're talking about high powered people like Ken Friedman and Mario Batali and April Bloomfield, career ending, and not just mm-hmm. career ending, like life ending. I mean, I watched people get lives destroyed by some of these people. When people responded with support, I could not believe it. And my heart, I just felt so... For the first time, I felt seen as an invisible person in the working class. I felt seen and heard. And that for me was just so filling. I didn't realize how much damage had been done by those years of silence and that those years of facelessness voicelessness.
Yeah.
And it was powerful for me. It was really like getting slivers of my soul back.
Yeah. I mean, part of it is that you spend so many years hearing and getting feedback that you're not human. And you sort of screaming back into the void, but yes, I am. And then to finally have that recognized is it's liberating.
Well, it's liberating. And it was also extremely shocking for me during this, that the beginnings of Me Too, I assumed that this was a working class issue. I assumed as a woman that there was going to be a time in my life where I got to a certain position in my notoriety, whatever it was that I was putting out into the world, that people would respect me because I would have accomplished A, B, or C. And then all of these things that I had been dancing around my entire life would then magically disappear because I would have status. That's something I was aiming at. I was aiming for that goal. And when I discovered that people like Ashley Judd and Hillary Clinton and like all of these women that I had assumed had reached a level of their life experience where they were untouchable to these kinds of derogatory, you know, soul dismantling experiences, I just assumed that was the true divide between the well-heeled and the working class. Women didn't have to deal with that after a certain point of success. And that was mind-blowing, that actually, no, every woman, whether you're a scientist, a mathematician, a florist, you are having to do this dance. It's a part of the deal. And who made that bargain? I want to rewrite this.
One of the things that I find the hardest to swallow is when other women don't support women in these spaces. For y'all, the head chef was April Bloomfield, and the assumption would be, yes, she'll support the women who are facing this kind of behavior. But that wasn't the case. What did that feel like?
Well, I mean, the problem, you know, the thing about April that is very hard to wrap your mind around is that as far as abusers go, she was the most abusive. She was the most volatile, verbally abusive person I've ever encountered in my entire life. And it was accepted. She was tyrannical. She would kill people as careers. She would destroy them. Mm. And so in a way, they were like the dynamic duo of volatility, because she would create this fear-induced scene, which is pervasive throughout kitchen culture. This, for some reason, power and fear seemed to have been like this metric that people thought, well, that's what power is. You just make everyone fearful of you. And so she really delved it. She went down that path, and then Ken capitalized on kind of that environment, that volatile. He capitalized on the all of these broken people that were being destroyed by her. So she was never a person you were going to be able to go to. And she didn't care about anyone but herself. And that was the hardest thing to understand. And I look at it with Harvey Weinstein's executives, female executives that led those lambs to the slaughter, that all of these women, that they too were conditioned to believe that they had to play into, they had to follow this playbook that is harmful to women. I believe in redemption. I just wonder how, now that, you know, the ground is settled, I wonder how some of those women have continued forward, and if they have enough self-awareness to understand their role.
I honestly don't know. What advice would you give to women who may feel that they're in a similar situation or have gone through a similar experience?
There is another side to it. It's very hard to speak your truth, but the power that it gives you inside this empowering feeling that you matter and that you are valued is irreplaceable. It's something that is invaluable. And to know that that's waiting for you, I can't guarantee that you won't be fired. We aren't there yet, but knowing that you were able to take back your own control is something that it's life-changing.
Yes. What is required to make the restaurant industry a safe working environment for women?
So I think that getting that inequity out of those power dynamics between owners and, you know, wealthy owners having pet projects, that needs to go away. Also, all of this legislation that's out there, we need to actually enforce it. We shouldn't have HR departments that are working for the company. All HR departments should be a part of something that you have to hire in, like buying insurance, so that they're not working for the company, they're working for the people. Mm-hmm. And they are able to then make, because people went to our HR department at the Spotted Pig, they were fired. Mm. I mean, Ken, you know, did horrible things to people, sexual things. And when they were discussed about, those people were gone. And anybody that stuck up for those people were gone. So yeah. We have to be able to bring in outside resources.
I know this episode might have been difficult for folks to listen to and might have triggered some of your trauma. I know it was difficult for me to talk about it. But ultimately, I hope this episode was informative, that folks felt seen, and that it provided encouragement to those who might need it to speak about their own experiences. In the words of Trish Nelson, when talking about herself and fellow food industry workers, "Our contributions to the whole of our society, however small they may seem, are impactful and important. Women and working class people like myself are the backbone of our society, and we deserve just as much as anyone else to be respected and treated like human beings, especially when we are in our places of employment. We are not disposable." Check out restaurantworkerscf.org, a nationwide community dedicated to making the restaurant industry more hospitable to everyone. I'm your host and executive producer, Christina Gonzalez, and this has been Politics of Food. Remember to follow me on Twitter at Christina Aime and on Instagram at Christina_Aime75. Special thanks to my team at DCP Entertainment, executive producers Jackie Garifano and Adele Komen, and senior producer Ryan Woodhall. If you like the show, please listen, like, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. For more information, visit dcpofficial.com. See you next week.